The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Weeks after the French surrender to the oncoming storm of Nazi forces, a young man named Zora Arkas Duntov hid in the back room of a brothel with his brother in the port city of Bordeaux. They knew they were wanted men, given that they were not only Jews born in Belgium, but also because they were both members of the French Air Force. Zora had secured exit visas to the United States for his wife and family as Nazi tanks rolled through the French countryside. The Arkas Duntov family was ready to run like hell, but the only problem was Zora's wife, Elfie. She was still working in Paris, and Nazis were descending on the city. Elfie, a ballet dancer, packed all of her things into her tiny MG and sped off in the middle of the night to avoid capture. As she raced the 375 miles from Paris to Bordeaux in the drop-top sports car, Nazis were right on her tail in their Kubel wagons. But the 1250cc motor on the MG used all 54 horsepower to keep Elfie safe and return her to the arms of Zora. We may never know if she was upset that Zora was hunkered down in a brothel while she was in a multiple hundred-mile car chase with literal Nazis, but a few days later, the two boarded a ship to Portugal, which eventually took them right into the loving embrace of America. It was there that Zora Arkas Duntov was fated to become the legend we all know him as today, the father of the Corvette. But how did Zora get that title? Today on Pass Gas, we're going to talk about the origins of the Corvette, how it became such an icon, here's a hint, Zora helped a ton, and why it took Chevy 60 years to release a mid-engine model. This is Pass Gas.
Pass Gas Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about ports.
That was an exciting intro. It's like a movie, dude.
I thought you were going to say, why it took Chevy 60 years?
Why it took Chevy 60 years to hunt for the Red October?
We're just talking nonsense now, as usual.
Gotta get that energy up, dude.
Yeah.
Woo! Ha!
That's me getting my energy up.
That's getting your yeah-yeahs out.
Oh yeah, we've started recording at 9 a.m. as opposed to our usual 10 a.m. And I do think it's a little harder to get rolling in the morning. Although it does give us a lot more time later in the day, so it's a bit of a trade off.
Well, Joe anyway, and I have been up since 4 doing calisthenics and brain exercises. I don't know. Did you sleep in today or something?
I did hit that sleep in today.
That's pretty irresponsible of you. Yeah. If you want to be a fast track exec, you got to start getting up at 4 and doing calisthenics and brain exercises.
And brain exercises.
Yeah.
I did 1,001 push-ups in front of a mirror.
Wow.
And didn't break eye contact with myself.
How Patrick Bateman of you.
More like Gary Vee, my hero.
I do like that there's this weird kind of thing where waking up early is as some sort of like moral booster, you know, some sort of like, oh yeah, he gets up early, therefore he's doing well for himself, or he's on top of it.
Yeah, what if he just gets drunk till just gets drunk till 7 p.m. and passes out and like wakes up at 4 just like
I literally can't sleep past 4.
Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. I'm Nolan Sykes, joined as always by one Joe Weber.
Keep it. Yeah.
Whoa, with some Doppler effect. That was cool. And James Pumphrey.
Oh, you think darkness is your ally? You merely adopted the dark. I was born in it, molded by it. I didn't see the light until I was already a man. By then, it was nothing to me but blinding.
Wow. What a catchphrase. What a catchphrase, man. Yeah. That's really good.
I'm going to put it on a shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. I think people would really love that in 2013.
Yep. I'm in talks with DC and No Fear.
Oh.
Which is really just a dream collab for me.
Wow, that's awesome.
It's you should so make shirts with the Joker's face on it and Bane quotes.
Well, it's a big deal that I'm big drop I'm doing with DC. I have the Joker Osiris skate shoe.
Whoa.
Coming out too.
It has like the lipstick on the toe cap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And on the back it says, "Why so serious? R.I.P. King." 1976 to 2012.
That's a Osiris D3, the big ass shoe. Yeah. Oh, I love that. Dude, a Joker themed D3 would actually go pretty hard, I think.
That would sell out instantly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure.
I'm excited.
We should just
about
get
it.
Someone to airbrush it.
I'm excited about it.
Anyway, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's do it. Enough bands for today, mate. If you guys could have any generation Corvette, what would it be?
Oh, second gen.
Yeah, second
Stingray
gen.
Stingray, for sure.
Stingray's sick. Would you have like the original engine in it, or would you do a different
I would
LS or something?
No, just original. It's weird. I'm not like one of those everything is sacred kind of guys, you know?
Yeah.
The longer I work at Donut, the less I feel that way.
Yeah.
But when it comes to for something about the C2 Corvette, that Stingray is like, I'd want one as original as possible.
I really enjoyed the C8 we got. I think I love the C2, and I think the Stingray is sick, but just for, you know, if I'm daily driving it, I would take the C8.
Yeah, C8 was pretty sick. All right. These days, it's impossible to think of the hot rodding community without seeing a bow tie front and center on at least half the cars. The Chevy 350 small block was the rock that the church of car modding was built upon, or at least hot rodding. But back in the early 1950s, that just wasn't the case. Those greaser guys in leather jackets were hardcore blue oval fans because Ford saw the value in moddable motors, and the flathead V8 was their moneymaker. The flathead V8 that Ford was producing was a real innovation back in the day. It was the birth of the monoblock engine block design. But because it was still the 1950s, basically the dark ages of car modding culture, that flathead still needed a lot of work. That's where the Nazi-fleeing Zora Arkus Duntov comes in. Before he started as an assistant engineer at Chevy, Zora was eyeballing the flathead and had some ideas of his own. He designed custom cylinder heads for the flathead V8 called the Ardun. Oh, wow. Which converted the block into an overhead valve configuration. This overhead valve design routed the exhaust more directly, keeping temperatures down and drivers happy. Okay, just to like put some context as to why that's important. The flathead V8 had its valves were in the engine block. I'm trying to like imagine how he accomplished this. You'd have to like plug the holes where the valves came in to convert it to an overhead design. That's super cool.
I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Okay, so like a flathead, it's called a flathead because mm-hmm. it's literally just a flat piece of like cast iron that's bolted on to where the, you know, this the engine block, right?
Yeah.
So like normal modern cylinder heads, like, you know, your entire valve train is on top of the cylinder, like, right. So like the camshafts are in there usually. And they're pressing the valve down into the combustion chamber in the engine block, right?
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of opposite on a flathead engine. So you still have your engine block and cylinders and all that, but next to where the pistons are pumping up and down in the cylinders, you've also got your valves sitting, like, I think on top, right? And they're also going into the combustion chamber, the valves, but from the bottom, from the engine block.
Oh, okay.
If that makes sense. Can you visualize that?
Yeah, now I'm understanding, like, that would be a feat of engineering.
Yeah, so now Zora is taking basically like a modern cylinder head, and he's placing where the valves are going. Yeah, or yeah. Where the valves are coming in. That's pretty amazing. I want to know how he did that. Anyway, the point is that like this sort of design, like I said, routes the exhaust can exit a combustion chamber more easily, which increases airflow, which is what you want. It keeps temperatures down and overall gives you more power and makes drivers more happy. So that's fun. Zora's overhead valve design was a hit, and to celebrate, the Belgian moved to England, where he helped to develop Allard sports cars for the 24 Hours of Le Mans in 1952 and 1953. Under the hood of those cars was Zora's old friend, a Ford flathead V8. After bolting on his invention, he and the soon-to-be racing legend Carroll Shelby raced the Allard cars together and won more than half a dozen races. I did not know that they worked together. Dude.
That's cool. So, dude, it's when you start talking about this era of cars, it's like, oh, and then this, like, if they put it in a movie, you wouldn't believe it.
Yeah. And no. That's when Zora went to the starting line down in Riverside and met Ken Miles. And, and like,
it's like Walk Hard.
Yeah. Yeah. We should do a Walk Hard with just racing car
drivers. Yeah. That'd be great. Drive Hard.
Drive Hard.
Dude, it's already written itself.
Yeah.
In 1953, Zora returned to the U.S. At the New York Auto Show, he spotted the sleek, all-new 1953 Corvette on display. And like many, he found the car visually superb. But as a racer and race mechanic, he was disappointed at what was hidden under the hood. The first-gen Corvette wasn't built like the models we know and love today. It was heavily inspired by the MG and other European sports cars, much like the one his wife used to flee the Nazis. Sure, it was more polished and streamlined, but under the hood sat a disappointing inline six-cylinder engine with three single carbs perched on top and a two-speed Powerglide transmission crammed underneath. Zora had fallen in love with the curves, but knew the rest of the car needed serious work. So,
yeah.
Damaged goods under the hood.
Oh my god.
Sorry.
The Corvette had, or Chevy had made the Corvette because all these GIs were coming home from Europe and they're like, they had all fallen in love with these cars that they saw over there and probably took for joy rides over there.
Mm-hmm. They were shipping some back too.
Yeah, we want something like this. And Chevy was like, okay, let's do it. He fell in love with the curves and took a job as an engineer at GM with the hopes of winding up on Team Corvette. Once he was on staff, he boldly wrote a letter to all of his bosses titled Thoughts Pertaining to Youth, Hot Rodders, and Chevrolet.
I love that.
Where he laid out exactly how Chevy would beat Ford into submission in the hot rodding scene. In the letter, Zora argued that securing the lead in the high-performance game took more than a good motor. He waxed poetic about aligning chassis and engines while offering an aftermarket environment for modders to tinker around in. His bosses, surprisingly, took the letter to heart. They were wooed into allowing Zora to shoehorn a V8 into the 1955 Corvette, a first step in the journey towards the big block vets of the muscle car era. Zora was promoted to Director of High Performance Vehicles, a dream job for any car guy that involved two tasks: building custom fast cars and then taking those fast cars out to the track. Zora was living the life. He set records at Pikes Peak in a Bel Air. He took a Corvette to Daytona and broke the flying mile record at 150 miles per hour, introduced the Corvette to both fuel injection and four-wheel disc brakes, all in his first 2 years. And what was even more amazing was that Zora was just getting started.
Man, back then, Pikes Peak was dirt and rocks and probably not that well maintained. And can you imagine doing it in a car that's barely smaller than Nolan's Oldsmobile?
That sounds like the dream job, though, like for this dude. Like, that is just the perfect scenario for this guy to fall into.
The higher-ups at Chevrolet were ecstatic with their new hire and ready to let Zora take the Corvette to the next level, but they weren't ready for just how next level he was willing to go. Zora had logged quite a few hours of track time in Corvettes, and the severe cockpit heat problems were causing a ton of issues and discomfort. So, by 1957, he already had dreams of going mid-engine. Zora and fellow Chevy engineers Harold Krieger and Walt Zeschi started work on designing the Chevrolet Engineering Research Vehicle, also known as the Curve One. The all-new design was also called the Hill Climber because Zora had plans to run the car back up Pikes Peak, where he'd already set the production car record in 1955 in an enormous Chevy Bel Air.
But we all know that he really just wanted to go to that nice hotel at the base of Pikes Peak.
Yeah,
he wanted Chevy to foot the bill.
Yeah, all of this was because he loved that hotel.
And that Curve One, stylistically spelled C-E-R-V-1, so however you want to pronounce it.
Serve?
Dear listener. Would you serve, do serve? Curve.
I think it might be serve. But I thought whatever curve because he fell in love with the curves.
Oh,
that
nice.
Needed a lot of work. Needed a lot of work about it. Oh, damaged goods.
But it wasn't all about peaks. The Hill Climber was aimed at competing with other Indy cars and was powered with an experimental 353 horsepower 4.6 liter V8. That's more horsepower than the Corvette was making with a 5.7 liter 50 years later.
Wow, what happened to this engine?
I lost it. The three engineers had a list of features they weren't willing to sacrifice on, and they made that dream car a reality. It was a radical tube-framed, single-seat, open-wheel, independent rear suspension mid-engine monster that they hoped would lead to what one day would wear the Corvette badge out on public roads. Unfortunately, Zora's dreams of making the Curve or Serve One a production car remain just a dream. The car was just too insane for 1950s America, as well as the boardroom full of old men who made the decisions at Chevrolet. To put one last nail in the mid-engine coffin, the car never even saw competition due to an Automobile Manufacturers Association ruling which banned auto manufacturers from participating in factory-backed racing programs in 1957. That's a reality that's hard to imagine today. Zora didn't let the band get to him. He kept innovating and designing. Part of his genius was that he turned failures into learning opportunities. The Serve or Curve One wound up as a guinea pig used to test crazy theories and experimental motors. Before it faded into history, Zora raced the car GM's Milford Proving Ground, setting a baffling average speed record of 206.1 miles per hour on the 5-mile circular track.
Wow. Jesus.
That's average speed.
Average speed.
Yeah, what? I mean, this thing, I mean, it's an open-wheel race car. Like, an Indy car is an appropriate kind of description. But, man, when you look at it, you're like, okay, yeah, that thing is fast as hell. Like, you could just tell.
I mean, what's the average speed of an F1 car lap right
Depends
now?
On the track.
On a fast one.
Probably, like, 180.
Yeah, dude, 206.
Yeah, that's quick. But I mean, this is a big old oval, though, you know.
Yeah.
They can just pin it the whole time.
Pin it. Hawk it and get squirrely.
Dude, this thing rules.
Yeah, that's really cool. It looks like a Hot Wheel.
The aerodynamics are so sick. This is my next daily, dude.
Even though some of the earliest car designs were technically mid-engine, the design didn't achieve its full potential until the 1960s. Formula One racing engineers found endless advantages with the mid-engine platform, from weight distribution to aerodynamics and balance and ease of repair. Luckily, Zora already had a decade of experience building and racing them competitively. And just in case you don't know what we're talking about, you've got a few different engine configurations. You've got front engine, where the engine is in the front under the hood. That's like most cars. And there's mid-engine, where the engine is in between the two axles, right? And usually they're behind the driver, but there's technically front mid-engine as well.
Yeah.
And then there's rear engine, like Porsche. Porsche is basically the only manufacturer. Alpina and the A110 has a rear engine, but that's a deep cut. Yeah. So there you go. Mid-engine, front-engine, rear-engine.
And that means that the engine is behind...
behind the rear axle.
Then there's top and bottom engine, but we don't want to get into that. You got left and right engine. That's some crazy stuff.
With the Serv 1 serving R&D duties, Zora began constructing the Serv 2 in 1961.
This is one of the most insane looking cars I've ever seen in my life.
It looks like the Mach 5 from Speed Racer.
Yes. Uh-huh.
It looks like Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
I love that era where every single car manufacturer made those style headlights.
Mm-hmm.
Like those are like GT40.
There's only like four types of bulbs. So you had like a couple of round ones to choose from, a couple of square ones to choose from.
I'm talking about that shark, the shark shaped headlights on like the GT40 and like the Lamborghini and the
very aerodynamic
Ferraris. Yeah.
It all started with the motor that was currently bolted into the Serv 1, a 377 cubic inch aluminum V8. But this time, he wanted those 500 ponies to push their power to all four wheels. Just like the all-wheel drive 1935 Bugatti T5-3 race cars that Zora loved when he was a kid. The chassis of the Serv 2 was stuffed full of lightweight titanium and came in just under 1,400 pounds thanks to Larry Shinoda and Tony Lapine, designers of the Porsche 924 and 928. And by the spring of 1964, the race-inspired engine, all-wheel drive setup, and futuristic chassis all combined to break speeds of 212 miles per hour at the Milford Proving Grounds. Oh, here we go. Meanwhile, Bunky Knudsen, the general manager of Chevrolet at the time, was convinced that Zora had built him a GT40 killer to run at Sebring and Le Mans. They debuted the Serv 2 at the Formula One Grand Prix in Riverside, California, where Dan Gurney and Sterling Moss threw down competitive demo laps in the car. That's sick.
Here we go. Get the cast back in here. This is the Marvel Universe.
Yep. It was an eye-opening moment for competitors to see a major player like Chevrolet step suddenly and so competitively into their world. Hell yeah.
And then Dale Earnhardt walked in.
Yeah, but he was just a busboy at the bar that they hung out.
Just a few months later, though, Chevy did what Chevy does, and they told Zora to pack up the prototype and send it back to Detroit. There just wasn't enough money in the bank to take on a whole new racing program. And by the late 1960s, the Serv 2 had replaced the Serv 1 as a guinea pig for the Corvette program, and once again, Zora was disappointed. Yes, he was still learning and growing, but the failures started to sting. Dude, imagine how different car history might be if the Serv 2 was like at the 64 Le Mans with the GT40 and Ferrari, like a three-way fight, you know, that turns into a two-way fight between Ford and Chevy. What a missed opportunity.
It's just frustrating. It's so frustrating to see him like succeed and then just get shut down.
Yeah. Because there wasn't, quote unquote, enough money. Meanwhile, General Motors has been like one of the biggest companies in the world for like decades.
They have money to spend.
Yeah, they had money. Come on, son. Come on, son.
Come on, son. Chevy, come on, my son.
You're my son, Chevy.
Hi.
You're my son, and I love you, Chevy.
Zora wasn't about to quit. Before the Serv 2's corpse was even cold, he was already showing off a new mid-engine Corvette design that he was desperate to get into the public's hands. Because, see, the public, people vote with their wallets, okay? And he's sick of getting shut down behind the scenes by all these freaking suits.
Yeah.
So he's going to create a little thing called Demand. This time it was dubbed the XP882, and she was a beaut. Two prototypes were fitted with small block Chevys with plans for dropping in some big blocks later. This thing's really cool looking.
Yeah, this looks like a Stingray.
Yeah, it looks like a Lamborghini machine of the time.
Yeah, unmistakably a Corvette though. This actually looks like a C4.
Yeah, a little. I like it.
Yeah.
The Chevy styling team put together a look that was fresh, bold, and edgy, but also classically Corvette looking, just like Joe just said. Every team at Chevrolet, from sales, styling, and engineering, were on board with this new wild direction for the Corvette and ready to get them into the hands of drivers. Given the amount of energy and excitement around the project, it was quite a shock when Chevy general manager John DeLorean killed the project. His stated reason for nixing the XP882 was his desire to refocus the company on making Corvettes even more profitable, utilizing all new and way cheaper Camaro chassis. So basically he's like, all right, guys, we're not going to innovate. We're going to do the exact opposite. We're going to make the same car, but cheaper.
Look, I know I made my name by innovating and doing stuff, you know, bending the rules, but we're not, as long as I'm in charge, we're not going to break any rules. We're not going to do any risks. That's pretty freaking...
In 1971, Ford acquired an 84% stake in exotic car manufacturer De Tomaso, with plans to rebrand their all-new Pantera as their own. And Zora knew he had to strike while the mid-engine iron was hot. Zora went behind DeLorean's back and showed Bill Mitchell, head of design at General Motors, and Alex Mayer, Chevy's chief of engineering, the XP882 that had been mothballed. Mitchell and Myar fell in love with the mid-engine car instantly and told Zara to prep it to be shown at the 1969 New York City Auto Show to compete with the upcoming De Tomaso Pantera announcement Ford had planned. So this is exciting. They coated the concept car in silver paint and created a fake interior with just days to go. Then they shipped the car to New York, where it was a massive hit with fans, car journalists, and especially photographers, who plastered images of the wild ride all over every magazine cover in the industry.
It's so funny that like this stuff just comes together so quickly, or it could back then. It was a little more nimble, it sounds like. Uh-huh. Like just like slapping the interior together with days to spare.
That's what GM did when they sent the Hummer, basically, yeah. Right?
That's that, like, actually a fake fair. Interior? The interior, you could sit in it and all that. It was totally cool, but it was like the...
You could sit in it, but none of the buttons were real. You couldn't roll up any of the windows. Everything was like 3D printed and spray painted.
the drivetrain was
fake too.
Yeah, but weren't they saying they took it on like a trail like a couple days before and they had to clean up the whole car?
I don't know. Maybe they just like hobbled it out to take pictures.
Well, no, because the guy was saying that he spent like 2 days having to clean mud out of tons of crevices everywhere.
No, so, that's what he was. He had diarrhea. He didn't want to be graphic right. about it.
He was
it,
a very but... nice guy. I don't want to imply that he had diarrhea.
Auto journalists had diarrhea for the new Corvette. Word diarrhea. They went insane writing long stories about how the XP882 would be the next generation Corvette, which is exactly what Zora wanted. They praised the parts bin, but very clever powertrain setup. Under the silver body of the XP882 was a transverse-mounted 400-cubic-inch V8 coupled to a turbo 400 transmission.
Nice.
The wheels and suspension were cobbled from existing production parts, keeping costs low. Zora had learned how to play the game.
That's the name of the game.
DeLorean was embarrassed. He also felt a bit betrayed. Zora had gone over his head and straight into the loving arms of the public and press. DeLorean was forced to approve the funds to develop a big block XP882 after the overwhelmingly positive reception. But as we all know, we didn't get a mid-engine Corvette until like
2020.
I think we saw one in 2019. So that's why I get confused. We were the first ones to get one, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, let's just say they had to clean a lot of mud out of the C8 they sent us.
All eaten crawfish right before that. And we all got diarrhea. Anyway, so we know that obviously the story didn't end there, because we didn't get a mid-engine Corvette until 2020. So what happened? While DeLorean and Zora were having their little quibble, the big man at General Motors, Ed Cole, was making deals that neither man was in on. Just when the two had everything ironed out, Cole came in the room with his purchase order to license the development of a Chevy-branded Wankel rotary engine And he wanted the first one to be a high-performance version that would live in the heart of the Corvette.
That seems like a not good idea.
Yeah. Does no one talk at GM? What's going on?
Yeah, what the hell, dude? Oh, what like a out-of-touch boss move.
Yeah.
It's like, no, dude. Dude. Ed Cole walks in with the rotary engine. He's like, you guys got to use this. And after Zora was done being very upset, he ordered one of the head of R&D engineers, Gibb. He ordered one of the...
Why do you always get these names?
He ordered one of the head R&D engineers, Gibb Hufstadter.
Hell yeah.
Pretty good. To tackle the rotary problem and make it a reality. He even handed over the keys to the XP882. So... it could be taken to the chop shop and fitted with the experimental four rotor engine that had been floating around Chevy engineering meetings. Rob Dom.
I mean, four rotor is pretty cool.
Dude, if they had Rob Dom.
Oh, yeah. Rob would there, hook that up, dude.
Yeah.
Then the Corvette would be a rotary.
But this is so funny because they're usually like, you know, you usually hear the story is like, oh, yeah, like the whole narrative of the, like when the C8 was coming out, there's a ton of articles about the timeline of the mid-engine legacy, and it's always like, yeah, one of them was going to be rotary, isn't that crazy? But now it like makes a lot more sense. It doesn't like come out of left field. It's like, okay, yeah, they were already working on one that wasn't going to be rotary, and then you know,
someone's like, yeah, now let's just do all the hard stuff right away.
Yeah. So it's, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. The 60s had ended, as they always do, with 69. Nice. And the 70s were in full swing. Zora was begging to make the mid-engine Corvette a reality, but reality wasn't working out too well for him. Cue oil crisis music.
We'll get back to more past gas, but right now, a word from our sponsors.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you, and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The GM team now had to weather the first Arab oil embargo and the 1970s recession, which floated in a period of stagnation and interest rates of almost 20%. Corvette sales dropped 50% in the early 70s, and Ed Cole was waving around his stupid rotary build sheets in the hopes of paving a new road to the future. None of it looked good for Zora. It was a perfect storm of reasons not to turn an experimental project into a reality. By 1975, Zora Arkus Dunkov was exhausted. He retired from GM and left Detroit without ever achieving his one big dream, putting a mid-engine Corvette into the hands of enthusiasts.
That's a bummer, man.
Yeah. Damn,
dude, that's a freaking sad.
It's cool that we still know his name, though, and that he's like still a legend, despite not having any of his projects come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like an experimental designer in Detroit. Like, he's like, what's like a music equivalent?
Salvador Dali's.
Yeah, he's like the Salvador Dali of cars. I want to make the Zora story, but make it like real Disney and have animals play all the characters.
Oh, nice. I've already started looking at what he looks like to see if I could cast him. And
what,
I think,
what animal does he look like?
Some kind of like sharp, clever fox, maybe.
Yeah, like a fox, I was thinking.
Yeah, but I think if it ever was a live action movie, I think John Bernthal could play him.
He does look like John Bernthal, but John's already playing
playing
Lee Iacocca.
We cast John Bernthal in every movie.
I know. Yeah, we only know four. Timothy Chalamet, Chris
John
Evans.
John Bernthal is going to be like, if we ever make this like super Walk Hard movie, we have to have John Bernthal play like 15 characters.
Yeah.
That would save money on casting.
Okay, guys, what if we animate it like a Disney movie, but then in 20 years, we do the live action version, which is just...
On ice skates?
No, like the Lion King or Mulan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The 1970s were not kind to performance cars, and it was probably for the best that someone who lived and breathed roaring ponies like Zora Arkus Duntov stepped down. His replacement, Dave McClellan, oversaw the slow, sad decline of what was once a monster of a 500-horsepower manual muscle car into an anemic automatic transmission lump. We all know the story. Emissions regulations detuned the boulevard beasts that enthusiasts loved and neutered them into wheezing puppies. Gas prices soared, and Corvette owners were getting too old to drive sports cars and wanted Cadillacs instead. One side effect of this was Corvette buyers choosing automatic over manual in massive numbers. And by the late 70s, more autos were being produced than sticks. America's beloved chrome bumpers were also being killed through increasingly stringent safety standards. By the time they were replaced with safer plastic, the once great but now pathetic Vette was making a Honda Fit-esque 165 horsepower through a shockingly bad 3-speed turbo hydromatic automatic transmission. During these truly dark times, former mid-engine and Zora ally Bill Mitchell took a look back at past designs and decided that the only road out of the awful 70s garbage fire was through the mythical mid-engine Corvette they'd been chasing all along. Mitchell made a few calls and then pulled the XP-895 out of storage. The XP-895 was the rotary Frankenstein that Zora had tasked Gib Hufstadter to build out of the XP-882's ashes.
A lot of, you're getting through this minefield of sentences right now.
It's
pretty well.
It's hard. I'm sweating. Mitchell ordered the rotary motor to be thrown in the trash and grabbed a 300 horsepower Chevy V8 off the parts shelf. Mitchell loved Euro mid-engine sports cars and saw the newly dusted off XP-895 as a spiritual competitor to the Countach and the Ferrari Dino. Mitchell dubbed the gullwing beast the Aerovette. He shipped it off to the auto show circuit, and once again, enthusiasts and the media lost their minds over the idea that a mid-engine Corvette was coming. Rumors circulated throughout the 1970s, and then it was officially greenlit. The Aerovette was set to become the C4 in 1980, the fourth generation Corvette.
I told you, I called it. Looks like a C4.
Dave McClellan, who decided that Zora's dreams never really mattered, put a halt to the Aerovette before it even got going, much to the dismay of Bill Mitchell and everyone who ever wanted to buy Corvette. McClellan gave a plethora of reasons why he killed the Aerovette. The chief amongst them was that he didn't see the mid-engine platform as being performance-oriented enough. What? Come on, son!
Come on, son!
Come on, son! You're my son,
come on,
Dave
Chevy,
McClellan!
Son.
Come on, son!
Come on, my son Chevy.
He believed that front engine was the only way to go when it came to sports cars.
Oh,
and,
son.
Wow, son.
Wow,
come on, son.
Come on,
wow, son.
Son. Come on.
Son.
For more than 30 years, Corvette designers and engineers toiled away in back rooms cranking out mid-engine prototypes that were swiftly killed by the bean counters. Overall, they mothballed 9 different mid-engine prototypes. Nolan, didn't you do a wheelhouse that said that's not exactly how that works?
Like
very often, like it's not very often that like it's like accountants being like, you can't make it.
Oh, right. Yeah. What episode was that?
SVT.
Yeah, that's right. So with the SVT episode, good pull, James. The SVT Ford episode that we did, the accountants are a good scapegoat. It's fun to pin blame on them. I mean, we definitely have a lot in the past. But really a lot of the times it comes down to like product timelines not matching up and a lot of other things that are just outside of the design team's control that leads to the end of these fun projects, you know?
Yeah. A lot of things have to align for a new car to come out.
a staggering amount of stuff.
And it's not always one factor.
Yeah. Leave the accountants alone.
Yeah.
They count so you don't have to.
Well, it's it's like when people last year were like asking us, like, when's the next season of High Low is coming out? It's like, we wanted to make High Low. We just, like, everything was out of our control, so we couldn't do it, you know? But now, like, we finally are.
Comes out at the end of the summer.
Yeah, so it'll be there.
Post-Zora, though, only one of the concepts rose to the top and nearly secured the Corvette name. It was the mid-80s, and pretty much the only cool cars were coming out of Italy. But those designers in the U.S. were still all hopped up on Coke and big dreams, and they wanted to compete. They called their dream the Corvette Indy, named after Harrison Ford's character in Indiana Jones.
Whoa, this looks like if a Camaro had a baby with, like a catfish had a baby with an NSX.
Does it have big old whiskers?
I don't like this.
Too much glass, I think.
I've seen this car so many times. I don't like it. I don't like this, like, era.
I like the rear end a lot. I don't like the front very much.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's very cyberpunk.
Yeah. It's like dated future.
Yeah. Yeah, like, for sure.
The only car that can pull this off is the Ford Probe. Like, this style of, like, futuristic, but also curved.
The Probe, the example of
it's a high watermark for all cars.
GM Design Vice President Chuck Jordan and staff GM designer Tom Peters put together a design for a Corvette body with a super lean supercar shape that looked like a Testarossa hitched up with the WS6 Trans Am. Jordan and Peters saw the body as the perfect home for their all-new cutting-edge 80s motor. Plus, with the scissor doors that incorporated the windows and roof, no one had to worry about little problems like cockpit space or window motors. The heart of the Corvette Indy was an innovative 2.65-liter V8 with a pair of spinny boys that put down more than 600 horsepower to the rear wheels.
That seems cool.
2.6-liter V8 is sick.
Yeah, probably sounds awesome. But it sounds especially amazing. Those turbos, yeah.
But the motor wasn't the only showstopper. The sleek body of the Indy was an aeronautical mass of carbon fiber and Kevlar that was formed over a bespoke monocoque chassis. GM hit up Lotus and added their active suspension to the mix while also incorporating an all-wheel drive system that sported four-wheel steering. It was the most innovative thing Chevy had done since they introduced the 350 small block in 1967. How many cars at this time were just like hitting up Lotus at this time and being like, hey, can you figure out our suspension? DeLorean did it. a bunch of people did it.
Yeah. I mean, Colin Chapman was a genius.
He's a genius, mate. We'll take it to Colin. He's a genius.
Add lightness. Take off weight. What was it?
Yeah. Add lightness.
Remove weight and add lightness.
Yeah. Well, I love that. So cheeky. That dude's so cheeky, man. Wonder what he's up to now.
We'll talk about it after the show.
Dude, he hasn't called me like in a couple years. I wonder if he's all right.
Within 6 weeks, the Indy went from clay slab to show car, and the bow tie bigwigs ordered it to be displayed at the 1986 Detroit Auto Show, where once again, everyone fell in love with the look and performance. The bosses loved the crowd reaction, and once again, the mid-engine concept was greenlit for production. This time, though, they were totally serious. Believe us. But once again, at the last minute, the beautiful idea was slaughtered before it ever saw the light of day. It was a cruel twist of fate. They changed the name to the Serve 3 and parked it at the GM Heritage Center alongside the picked-over carcasses of the Serve 1 and Serve 2, which were mostly there to remind everyone how much they let Zora down over the years.
Dang, burn. Wow.
A lot of subversive writing in this. I love it.
As years passed, Chevy did continue to innovate with front engine rear drive setups that had become a tradition with the Corvette from C4 to C6. Cars were getting better, and the dark days of the 70s and 80s were gone. The Corvette was fun again and won tons of awards while boosting sales numbers. the higher-ups had pretty much forgotten about the mid-engine concept along their path to perfecting the flagship Corvette's performance. Corvettes were getting so good, it was getting hard to justify tinkering around with a whole new platform. And when Zora and his predecessors were working in the background to realize their dreams, GM bosses would smack them down and say that the front-engine platform was doing great, and there's plenty of room for improvement. But after the stagnation of the C6 ended, a new chief engineer for the Corvette, Taj Euchter, barely even noter, took over duties of releasing the next generation. There was a floating question of, where does it all go now? Where does it go, Taj?
Taj Euchter.
Taj Euchter. In the mid-2000s, government-appointed accountants were inspecting GM's books after a probe into some of their reported earnings, and they found something very interesting.
Ooh.
The Washington analysts discovered something GM should have known already. The Corvette was one of the corporation's only sources of true profit.
No way.
As soon as the...
Dude, no way, dude.
Dude.
No way, dude.
Dude, freaking...
Dude, no way, dude.
Washington bean counters, dude. Washington bean counters.
That's where the best of the best go to count beans.
Yeah. I just want to go to Washington one day and count all the biggest beans. As soon as the analysis was finished, Euchter got a call from his bosses and was told it was full steam ahead on a new C7 after he'd been keeping the C6 on life support for years due to lack of funding. Euchter had a choice to make. Take a leap of faith and bring a mid-engine Corvette to the market, or redesign the traditional tried-and-true front-engine platform for an easy win. Well, Euchter took the coward's way out and developed what turned out to be an amazing performance car. One of the best. The front-engine C7 Corvette was one of the most well-received vets or sports cars in history, and the performance numbers were better than people had hoped for. Way better. And Euchter returned to the top of the podium with each new special model, like the Z06, the Grand Sport, and the absolutely insane 755 horsepower ZR1.
Yeah,
but
that is crazy.
While Euchter was getting high fives all around for his little home run with the C7, he was secretly building Zora's dream car behind closed doors.
Nice, Taj. We wrote him off like a bean counter. Taj came through, dude.
Always Taj.
Oh, dude, I'm sad, dude.
Taj is like Han Solo, like a kind of salty, you know, anti-hero guy, and you think he abandoned the quest, but then like at the last minute comes back and is just like, shoo, pew, 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 and you're like
a Samwise, like a classic Samwise Gamgee, help you out in the end.
For sure. I think Han Solo is the best.
I don't know why I tried to improve it. It's definitely Han Solo. It's not Samwise.
Oh, you know who's like that's like one of the coolest characters ever. But what if we took Rudy and made him real short? He's cool too.
We'll put him like up against some really tall people so he looks even shorter than he actually is.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
While Taylor Swift was blowing up on the radio with Shake It Off, and the C7 was winning Automobile of the Year and Performance Car of the Year, Car and Driver was once again predicting that 2015 would be the year a mid-engine Corvette was released. And guess what, guys? They were wrong. But by this point, Euchter had a green light on the mid-engine project, and this was different from the green lights of the past. The recessions were somewhat over, there was no gas crisis, and Dodge was selling Hellcats and Demons all day long. The time to release a mid-engine Corvette had arrived. Chevy wanted the prototype to be a secret, but auto magazines and paparazzi were always watching. So, to keep the project under wraps, they nicknamed it Blackjack and imported a Holden Maloo pickup truck that they used to build the bones of the C8's platform. This was no regular souped-up ute.
The pictures of this thing are amazing.
It's so funny. Yeah. The Maloo was chopped to bits. So basically, it's like a modern El Camino.
Mm-hmm.
Like a sedan in the front, truck bed in the back, okay? The Maloo was chopped up to bits and given a huge wing, Rocket Bunny-esque flared fenders, and the front end of a tweaked C7. The weird choice of platform didn't fool anybody, and the minute it was spotted on a test track, everyone knew exactly what they were looking at.
Yeah, I guess they had to use the ute to hide the, like, in an attempt to hide the engine.
Yeah.
So they're like, oh, what's that truck over there? Oh, it's just hauling an engine around in the back.
Around the track really fast.
Yeah, it looks ridiculous. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
With the constant fear of being canceled, Team Corvette kept developing Blackjack. Photos of camouflage prototypes kept popping up, and they kept thinking the next year would be the year for the new mid-engine Corvette. But the engineers kept trudging on, but now with a bit more hope. A few hand-built prototypes turned into a fleet of more than 100 fully developed vehicles with Italian supercar proportions, powered by a small block 6.2-liter, 495 horsepower V8 sitting behind the driver's seat that powered the new model to 0 to 60 in just under 3 seconds. Every day that passed made engineers more hopeful that Blackjack was going to become the C8. In April of 2019, Chevy made an official announcement that the mid-engine Corvette was about to become a reality. And while they hadn't revealed the design yet, the idea was being made public. And on July 18th, 2019, 60 years in the making, Chevrolet unveiled the first mid-engine Corvette. Enthusiasts went buck wild, but they were still a bit hesitant. Corvette fans held their breath all the way until February 3rd of 2020, when production officially began on the C8. When did we shoot that episode of Bumper to Bumper?
July 2019.
That was in July?
Yeah, because I always look back at our like views, and it's just like pretty consistent, and then just boom.
Yeah.
For the C8 reveal.
We were like one of the first people to get the Corvette to shoot, which was like so awesome.
Yeah.
And that video did so well for us, man. Mm-hmm. That was amazing. Automotive journalists lost their minds and showered the C8 with awards. Buyers wanted to get their hands on the C8 as soon as possible, but there's a six-month waiting list to bring one home. It was everything that Zora Arkus Duntov had been dreaming of, and it was the exact reaction from fans he'd been predicting since the 1950s. Chevy isn't resting on their laurels either. In homage to the Corvette's biggest fan and greatest patron saint, they are creating the Zora, a hybrid monster expected to make 1,000 horsepower to the wheels. And while the C8 might be a little different than anything Zora imagined, it's hard to think that he'd be anything but pleased. And that's the story. Yep, that C8 kicks ass. And while it took a long time to get here, I think it came at the right time. I don't know. It's just like they nailed it. It's so good. They just nailed it first time out that...
Yeah.
If they had done it any earlier, I don't know if it would have been the same, you know?
It's so cool. It looks f-ing awesome. It drives amazing. It's really fun. It made me a Corvette, dude.
Yeah, I am looking forward to the refresh. It's a little sharp right now. It's a little pointy. The rear end in particular, I don't think looks very good. But none of that really matters when you're driving it. It truly is amazing. And I'm not even like a Chevy guy. I'm a Mopar guy saying that. Okay.
Whoa, dude, that's as a Mopar guy, that's so big of you.
Yeah. I'm being the bigger man right now, Joe.
Yeah. Yo, well, are you going to take your Calvin peeing on Chevy sticker off your car now?
It's going to be hard to get that tattoo removed, that's for sure. Anyway, that's the story of the mid-engine Corvette. Thank you very much for listening. We got some reader emails to read right now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mitch writes to us. Hello, Mr. Pumphrey, Mr. Sykes, and the elusive Mr. Weber. My name is Mitch, and I live in the southern part of England, and I have a question about the popularity of different cars in the U.S. of A. Over here, hot hatches are the cars to have, whether it's a 15-year-old Renault Clio, a Mini, a Corsa, or a VW of some description, or a brand new Golf or Polo GTI, or a Toyota Yaris GR. Everyone has owned and loves them. I suppose similarly to trucks over your way. So what I'm saying is, do you find people love hot hatches in the U.S. or nah? As judging by the podcast in the U.S., everyone either wants a Japanese import truck or muscle car.
I'd say hot hatches are pretty popular here. I do think that drifting made them, like, I think that in the 90s and early 2000s, like, hot hatches were basically what import guys built.
Yeah.
And then drifting happened, so everyone got rear-wheel drive cars. But I do think that, like, fast Civics and Volkswagens and stuff are going to come back in a big way.
And, like, I see a decent amount of, like, Ford Focuses here, like RS and STs.
Yeah.
And I see less RSs, but STs a lot.
Yeah.
I love hot hatches. I think we at Donut got burnt out on them a little bit, so we stopped talking about them as much. But we love them.
I mean, I love the Focus and Fiesta STs are like some of my favorite cars. They're just so good to drive. I will say it depends on where you live, though. Like, in the city, yeah, hot hatches are dope because, like, parking sucks. And you want to have something that you can drive really, you can have a lot of fun with, but also, like, put a TV in if you're moving or whatever. But, like, out in, like, more rural areas, it really is a lot of trucks. A lot of trucks and muscle cars.
Yeah. It's kind of weird because, like, America could be five different countries. And so it's kind of weird to paint it with a broad paintbrush. It's definitely depends on what area you live in. And a lot of people live in rural areas, and that's where trucks are more popular. That's where SUVs are more popular. But, in San Francisco or a Boston where streets are smaller and parking is shitty, then hot hatches, you can see a lot of them.
For sure.
I want to give a shout out before we go to an Australian friend, Ben Geddes. Ben Geddes, like
Ben
and
Geddes.
Bean Geddes. No. He sent, after our Peking to Paris episode, he sent me this. I think it's a historical reenactment, and they actually did it in, like, period correct cars, so I'm excited to.
And that's a DVD. It has a series of DVDs.
Says it has incidental nudity in it.
Read the rating on the cover, Joe.
It's rated PG for mild, coarse language and brief incidental nudity. So I'm excited to watch the nudity part of it and throw the rest of it away.
I want this next season of Hilo to also include some brief incidental nudity as well. I think that'd really elevate the show.
We'll figure it out.
All right,
but he also gave me this juice box, too. So,
keep it juice, man.
Keep it juice, Ben Geddes.
Keep it juice, Ben
Geddes. Thank you for your present.
All right. I just want to thank everybody for listening to the show. Your support really means a lot. And just feeling good about our fans and good about the show.
Yeah. Tell your friends. And this is going to come out after Father's Day, but tell your dad about our podcast. I'm sure he'll love it.
Yeah, tell your dad about it.
Tell your friends about it, because word of mouth is really how podcasts are still asked and shared. So,
and Word of Mouth is a great album by Ludacris.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And on that bombshell, follow Nolan at Nolan J. Sykes on social media. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at James Pumphrey. Follow Donut at Donut Media.
And if you'd like to email the show, you can email us at passgas@donutmedia.com with your questions, complaints, or compliments. I want to hear more complaints. How about that?
Yeah, I want more complaints. Give me some more corrections. Yeah. Give us some heat.
Give us some heat, Daddy.
You want the smoke? We want the smoke.
All right. See you later.